live from Earth. It's Space Radio. This is Paul Sutter, and coming up, we're talking about I'll Have a Moon on the Rocks, Please, and If I Have Time, Catch a Comet If You Can, Staring Into the Void, Light That Rocket, so many news, so little time, and of course, taking listener questions about all things in the universe. We record the show every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, so call 888-581-0708 to join the conversation. And in today's Blue Shift, I'll be talking about dumbing it down. But first, the news. Hello, space fans. Welcome to Space Radio. I'm Paul Sutter, astrophysicist at Ohio State, chief scientist at COSI, and for the next half hour, your agent to the stars. Got an exciting show for you today on Space Radio, where if it's above the Earth's atmosphere, it's in this show's universe. It lives on listener questions. We record every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern here in Studio A of WCBE Radio Columbus. So call 888-581-0708 now or leave a voicemail and I'll play the voicemail on the show. Get those calls in and we'll have a chat. You can also follow along on our live streams on YouTube and Twitch. Go to spaceradioshow.com for the links. You can join the Space Cadets tuning in live from Lancaster, California, Austin, Texas, Central Jersey, Warsaw, Poland, Copenhagen, Allentown, PA, Texas Hill Country, and more from around the universe. Seriously, folks, I prepped 10 minutes of show material top, so get those calls in. Before I start taking calls, I wanted to share some news. And like I said, we got a lot of news today, and who knows if I'll get to it or not. Here's something cool about the moon. The moon is dead and lifeless and altogether boring. Nothing interesting has happened on the moon for at least 3.5 billion years and probably longer. And yet we kind of want to go there. There's discussions. There's been on and off discussions for decades about maybe we should make a colony. They could do something useful like, I don't know, make X, you know, zero gravity cheese. I honestly don't know what we would do on the moon. But if you want a colony on the moon, you need resources. And the number one resource is air. The number two resource is water. Life requires water to survive. Now, we would prefer liquid water. That's the kind that's, you know, inside our bodies. But we will settle for frozen water because we can apply a little bit of heat to it and turn it into the liquid kind. So where we find frozen water, that makes potential colonization easier. And the moon might just have a little bit of frozen water. Now, it's hard to imagine how the moon could hold on to frozen water because the moon gets bathed in sunlight. All sides of the moon, you know, there's no such thing as a dark side to the moon. There's just a side that faces away from the Earth. But that side sometimes points towards the sun, so it gets bathed in sunlight. And it's kind of warm out there. The sun is kind of hot. And you may have noticed everywhere else in the inner solar system, there isn't a lot of ice. How can the moon have ice? Well, there might be some ice tucked into craters in the north and south poles. There might be some regions of these craters that are almost perpetually in shadow, where they don't get the full blast of sunlight and might survive as little pockets of ice. And there were some measurements made in the mid-90s with the Clementine spacecraft that were not very conclusive, but got a lot of people thinking. And there were some more observations made with the Moon Mineralogy Mapper, good old Triple M from NASA. Now, that is a decade-old mission. It's already done, but the data are still there, and they've been reanalyzed, and a team has put together a claim based at the University of Hawaii that, you know what, there was ice the whole time. We actually saw ice, but we didn't realize it was ice. Then they went ahead, and this is led by Jim Head, by the way. Great person to head a mission like this. A geologist from Brown University took this data from the Moon Mineralogy Mapper and combined it with later measurements from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is currently in orbit around the moon, put two and two together, And there's a pretty strong case that there is frozen ice, at least a little bit, in these northern and southern craters in the moon. And that's kind of interesting. This leads to other questions. If there can be ice there, is there any ice anywhere else? Is there ice underneath the layer, the surface layer of regolith? We dig down a little bit, we would find some ice. I doubt we'll find rice, but we just might find ice under the surface of the moon. And then you can live there and you can have a martini or something or whatever you do with ice. That's the latest and greatest when it comes to space. Let's have a conversation. We've got a space cadet question lined up from FrenchGamer777 over on Twitch watching live, asking if galaxies need supermassive black holes to form. So I believe I've mentioned this in this show before, and I should mention it again because it's kind of a cool concept. Every galaxy, the Milky Way, Andromeda, Triangulum, NGC 7764, all the other galaxies that we don't even have names for. There's a few hundred million up to 2 trillion galaxies in our observable universe. Almost all of them, not necessarily all of them, but almost all of them have giant black holes in their centers. Not just tiny black holes. I'm not talking about garden variety, backyard black holes that are a few times more massive than the sun. That's nothing. Can ignore those, but a super massive black hole. These are black holes at least at minimum tens of millions of times more massive than the sun. That is large. These are black holes so large that if you were to plop them into our own solar system, their event horizon, their boundary, would stretch to the orbit of Jupiter or Saturn or the Kuiper Belt. The smallest of these are tens of millions of times more massive than the sun. The largest are hundreds of billions of times more massive than our sun. Every single galaxy essentially hosts a black heart, a giant black hole in their centers. And you might be tempted to think when you're shown pictures of these, I mean, we don't have pictures, but we have visualizations of them. When you look at them and you think, wow, that's a lot of mass. That's a big black hole. You might be tempted to think that it might dominate the galaxy, that stars orbit that black hole. That giant black hole plays an important role in the evolution of the galaxy, and it does, but not through gravity. You could pluck those supermassive black holes outside of those galaxies, and basically nothing would change. These supermassive black holes are indeed huge. Don't get me wrong. I'm not here to besmirch their grand titles, but they are less than 1% of the mass of a galaxy. Supermassive black holes are big. Galaxies are way, way bigger. Gravitationally, they don't care about the supermassive black hole. They just happen to have them like a parasite in their centers, in their cores. Now, which came first? The giant black hole or the galaxy? We're not so sure. We think they co-evolved, that as galaxies grew from clumping together smaller bits billions of years ago, their black holes also grew. And we think there's a relationship. There's a relationship between size of a galaxy and size of its supermassive black hole. So there seems to be an evolutionary connection between them. So they might be connected. They might co-evolve. Supermassive black holes don't matter gravitationally whatsoever, but they do affect the history of a galaxy. And they do that through a very strange mechanism. Material falls into the black holes all the time. Say a big ball of material accidentally ends up in the core of a galaxy, starts falling into that black hole. That's a lot of gravity pulling that stuff into a really, really, really small volume. Like, you got a lot of stuff being pulled in. What is it going to do? It's going to heat up. What is a heated up gas going to do? It's going to glow. It's going to give off a lot of radiation. It's going to be hot. It's going to be incredibly, incredibly hot. That feeding black hole, something we call in active galactic nuclei will heat up the gas in its galaxy. Heat it up so much that it might prevent the formation of stars. Stars can only form in cool, dense pockets. If you heat up a gas, the gas can't get together and get nice and dense to make a star. So star formation shuts off, which limits the amount of stuff falling into a black hole, which shuts off that source of high intensity radiation. So the gas can start cooling down and then form stars. And the stars form, and more material can fall into the black hole and heat up and prevent stars from. And so there's this relationship. There's this relationship between galaxies and the stars inside them and how they evolve and how they grow and how they mature and the black holes. But it's not through gravity. It's through this mixing and heating. We think this is it's a roughly hypothetical picture here that I've just painted. Based on a few thin threads of evidence, we're not 100% sure on that picture that there is this co-evolution between the stars in a galaxy and black holes. We think that's going on, but we're not 100% sure. So black holes do affect their host galaxies, but not in the way you might think. I'm Paul Sutter, and this is Space Radio. I got to go on break here in a little bit. This show is brought to you by you. Go to patreon.com/PM Sutter to learn how you can support the show. That's right. You keep the show on the air, and I'll talk to you after the break.
Curious about Celtic music? Well, look no further than WCVE's own Toss the Feathers. Every Saturday afternoon, you can join Anna Dixon Oscard as she plays a variety of music from the Emerald Isle, including everything from traditional to trance, jigs to jazz, and more. That's every Saturday afternoon at 4, right here on WCBE, Central Ohio's NPR station.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Paul Sutter, and this is Space Radio. We've got more Space Cadet questions ready to go, but remember, you can join the conversation by calling 888-581-0708. You can call that number anytime. Leave a voicemail. We'll play that voicemail on the air and I'll answer your question. Or you can follow the live streams on YouTube and Twitch. Go to spaceradioshow.com for the links. So before I get to the question that came up from the Space Cadets, I do want to share a little bit of basic astronomy. Comets are cool, right? Who doesn't love a comet? Little fuzzy, little tail, something pretty to look at in a binoculars or telescope. And there's a comet heading our way, goes by the name of 21P Giacobini Zinner, named after the discoverers, of course, that is blazing through the inner solar system and is going to be nice sight all through the fall months in the northern hemisphere. So for those of you in the southern hemisphere, just skip forward a few minutes because none of this applies to you. But for us lucky guns up here in the northern hemisphere, we're going to get a nice view of this comet. You're not going to see it with the naked eye. This is a binoculars target. But if you have a pair of backyard binoculars, especially image stabilizing binoculars, you'll be able to catch this comet. I won't tell you how to find it because that's going to change as the months go on. So just go to the show notes, go to spaceradioshow.com, find this show. There'll be a link in the show notes to a map of where you can find it in the sky. But the advantage is most comets come pretty close to the sun, which make it hard to see because the sun is a little bit bright. This comet has a 6-year period, and it goes out past the orbit of Jupiter and then swings by to just around the orbit of the Earth. So it actually doesn't get too close to the sun, gets close enough that it gets a nice tail. And since it only comes to within the orbit of the Earth or about the orbit of the Earth, it never gets too close to the sun that you won't be able to spot it. So it's actually up in the evening skies and all evening long throughout the fall. So you can track it and you can watch it. Very cool comet. You don't get a lot of opportunities like that. It's only every, a couple years that you get a nice binocular comet that you can spot from your backyard if you get a decent enough sky. I bet for those of us going on the cruise, the AstroTour cruise in September, we're going to look for that sucker. We're going to do it. We're going to make it happen. Now, going from small scales like comets to large scales like the universe, and there's an interesting story that I'm going to let myself get distracted on. Our modern understanding of the universe owes a lot to people like Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo and Newton, for sure. But they also owe a lot to a guy named Tycho Brahe. Tycho Brahe was perhaps the best astronomer to ever live up until people after him. He didn't use telescopes because he was a contemporary with Galileo, just preceded the developments of Galileo, so he didn't have a telescope, but he had an observatory, a naked eye observatory, made the most detailed measurements of stellar positions and positions of planets, and he saw something funny in the sky. He saw a comet, and comets had been seen before for millennia. It's not like comets were a big surprise, but for a long, 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 long time, forever, people assumed that comets were something that happened in our atmosphere. They had no idea what it was, but they assumed it was natural and that it was something happening in our own atmosphere. But Tycho Brahe did some measurements of a comet that he saw. And if it was something in our own atmosphere, then you should be able to measure a distance to it using a method called parallax. A method called parallax is where you look at the same object from two different positions and it should wiggle around relative to the background. Like if you close one eye and then the other and you go back and forth like that, stuff close to you wiggles a lot, stuff far away from you barely wiggles at all. That's parallax. So you can use parallax measurements on objects in the sky. And he did a parallax measurement, and he knew how far away the atmosphere was. He knew how far away clouds were, like a few miles away. And the comet had to be further away than that. He was able to prove that comets are not atmospheric phenomena. They're something else. They are much, much further away. And that measurement was not the clincher, the final nail in the coffin for undermining our old view of the cosmos, but it may have been the first. Or the second, it was a big, big nail that these things that we had assumed to be atmospheric phenomena were really taking place far, far away. Tycho didn't know how far away. He couldn't measure it. All he knew was not in our atmosphere. Now, speaking of our universe, here's my brilliant segue. Speaking of the universe in our modern cosmological model, I have a question here from Campbell Duncan, also over on Twitch, one of the space cadets. I say in the show a lot, I use the phrase observable bubble of the universe, that there is a limit to what we can see. Our universe is very, very large, possibly infinitely big. That's a whole other kettle of fish. But our observable universe is definitely finite. It's finite because the universe is only so old, 13.8 billion years, and the speed of light is only so fast. So there is a limit to what can be revealed to us in that finite amount of time. And that is called the observable bubble. So yes, our observable bubble is growing. More and more of the universe is being revealed to us as time goes on. Not human timescales, but over the course of millions of years, our bubble grows larger. But our universe is also expanding. Stuff is getting carried out of that observable bubble. And the expansion of the universe is overwhelming that growth of the observable bubble. As we march forward in time, our view of the universe, ironically, gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Galaxies are being pulled away from view, even though time goes on. And eventually, we won't even see any other galaxy. There will be no other observable galaxies. And by eventually, I mean like a trillion, 10 trillion, 100 trillion years from now. Oh, I forget exactly how long, but it's not too far off, cosmologically speaking, of course. But the universe is, because it's expanding and because the expansion of the universe is accelerating, galaxies are being ripped out of our observable bubble faster than our observable bubble grows. So actually, with time, it shrinks. We're becoming more and more cosmologically myopic as time goes on, which is really lame. One last question here from the space cadet Steve Sharmer over on YouTube. Are there rogue black holes? And if so, can we track them? And are they a threat to our system? Everyone's always worried about black holes. Are they going to eat us? Are they going to rip us apart? Will we fall into one? The only way to see a black hole is if it has a companion. And that companion is feeding gas into it. And the gas lights up telling us that there's a black hole nearby. We can also detect black holes using a technique called microlensing, looking at the path of background images. We can catch a few black holes that way. We suspect there are a lot of black holes that are just floating around the galaxy, minding their own business. The nearest black hole that we know of is thousands of light years away, thankfully. But could there be a closer black hole that we can't see? Maybe. Maybe. So sleep tight tonight, kids. We're almost out of time today on Space Radio. But before we go, it's time for the Blue Shift. I'm Paul Sutter, and you're listening to Space Radio, and this is the Blue Shift, my opportunity to get just a little bit closer to you. And I want to talk today about dumbing it down. I wrote a blog piece. So if you don't know, I have a blog I call Ab Initio. It's a Latin phrase, means from the beginning. You can find it on pmsutter.com/notes. I've been doing it for a few months, just basically getting started, and they're super short. These are super short pieces because I don't got the time, you don't got the time, nobody got the time. And so it's a few paragraphs, a thought every week that I flesh out just a little bit. It's my approach, my philosophy. It's my approach to science. It's my philosophy of science communication, what my goals are, why I'm making the decisions I'm making. It's just collecting my thoughts and putting it out there for the world to react to. And in my latest Ab Initio blog post, I talked about the phrase dumbing it down and how much I hate it and how much it's used. Because you, the listener, listening right now, you're not dumb. You're not a dumb person. So why should I dumb something down in order to communicate with you? Because you're not dumb. You're very smart. I believe in you. You're an intelligent, capable person. It's not about dumbing down. That is an insult to you, the audience, the listener. That is an insult. Now, are you trained and equipped in the mathematics and the jargon? No, because you pursued a different career in life, a different path. So you haven't spent decades immersed in the language of astrophysics or science in general. So should we as scientists and science communicators expect you to understand it right off the bat, to read a paper abstract or to follow the math? No, but not because you're dumb. But it's because you're not trained in this. In your profession, you have your own jargon. You have your own techniques that are totally alien to me that I wouldn't be able to follow. So to me, it's not about dumbing down. It's about translating. It's about taking the mathematics in the jargon, which is the language of science, and translating it into a language you can understand. You're not dumb for not knowing Russian or French or Swahili. You just don't know that language, which is fine. So I'm here to be an interpreter, not to dumb things down to you, not to simplify things, but to speak it in a language that you can understand. It doesn't make it necessarily more simple or more dumb. It's just different. And unfortunately, this broadcast is almost done. Thank you for joining me on this voyage of space radio. Once again, I'm Paul Sutter, and this show is brought to you by the Ohio State University Department of Astronomy. Learn more at astronomy.osu.edu. This show is also brought to you by, you guessed it, you. Visit patreon.com/pmsutter to learn how you can contribute. That's PMSUTTER. Go do it now. Thanks to Greg Mobies for producing, Nancy Graziano for wrangling the space cadets, Dan Michalko for being awesome, and all the fine crew at WCB Radio for making this show possible. We record every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Call 888-581-0708 anytime. Leave a voicemail or join me on the air. You can also catch the YouTube and Twitch live streams. Join those space cadets. Go to spaceradioshow.com for the links. And of course, thanks again, Earthlings, for listening. See you next week. And remember, science is for sharing and of transmission.